Welcome to Amplify, a podcast about the future of Europe, produced by the DCU Brexit Institute. We cover the latest developments in European integration, including the Conference on the Future of Europe and the Next Generation EU Post-Pandemic Recovery Plan. I'm your host, Ian Cooper. This episode is a conversation with Professor Kalypso Nikolaidis, who is Chair in Global Affairs at the School of Transnational Governance at the European University Institute. Among her many accomplishments, she is one of the world's leading thinkers on transnational democracy. She was involved in the Conference on the Future of Europe as an expert, contributing to the Citizens Panel on European Democracy, Values and Rights, Rule of Law, and Security. In this conversation, recorded on October 6th, she shares her thoughts about that experience and more generally about the future of Europe.
Okay, I'm here in conversation with Kalypso Nikolaidis, and we're talking about the Conference on the Future of Europe, and also we might talk about the Next Generation EU and the future of Europe more generally. Kalypso, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Ian. I have great admiration for the work of DCU's Brexit Institute, so it's a pleasure to collaborate.
Thank you. That's very kind of you to say. This is a podcast, part of a series called Amplify, where we talk about the Conference on the Future of Europe and about Next Generation EU, but we can talk about broader subjects as well. But you actually had some experience as part of the Conference of the Future of Europe. When you worked together with one of the Citizens panels, can you describe what you did and what you saw in your interaction with the Conference on the Future of Europe?
Well, indeed, Ian, I was very lucky to be part of this process because the institution where I work, the European University Institute in Florence, was one of the four chosen from around Europe to host a session of one of those four panels. So as our listeners probably know, this Conference on the Future of Europe, which is more than a conference, it was an amazing process, and it's a bit of a misnomer to call it a conference, but in any case, had put together, four randomly chosen citizens group assemblies, which they call panels. Again, a kind of diminutive term, it's just a panel, but they were like assemblies of 200 citizens each, and which met in Strasbourg, then met virtually, and the third time for each, they met in one of our four places. So we in Florence had the one that was discussing democracy and the rule of law. And indeed, this was their last discussion. So they had to come up with final recommendations for EU institutions. So it was quite a crucial meeting. And as a scholar myself of transnational democracy, of course, it was a fascinating stage to observe as well as take part in. So when the students, I say students, you see, I tend to always say students because I love my students. And one of the things indeed that I accomplished, although this was a lapsus, but I'll say it right away, was to obtain the status of student Sherpas for my students. So they were able to be part of it and hang out with some of these randomly chosen citizens. There may have been 200 of them, but one third were between 16 and 25. So basically my students were right in the middle of that age group, and they could have more informal conversations, take care of them, show them Florence. Many of them had never been here. So we were all prepared, our students, the faculty that was involved, including because we'd been part of the process from the beginning. So observing and also as so-called expert contributing to some of the conversation. I say so-called expert because the first thing I did when I talked as an expert to the citizens was to try to kind of take a bit of a distance with this term. I feel that randomly chosen citizens assembly should not be deferent to the experts. They should hear different viewpoints, or they should get some knowledge that they may not have, but the experts should not be telling them what to do and think. So I was quite careful to frame myself as a so-called expert. But this was kind of my major involvement was indeed as a so-called expert, but also involving my students and also interacting with the institutions, with some of the citizens, randomly chosen citizens, with all the other experts, as a kind of epistemic community of that was going to, from the beginning, was committed to draw lessons from that whole process by observing it. But even before drawing lessons, which Ian, we're going to talk about in a second, what lessons we draw, I think your term amplify for this podcast is very, very important. Because if there was one, maybe the main flaw or problem of this conference and these citizens panels is that they were a well-guarded secret. And the gap between how amazing this experiment was of bringing citizens from 27 countries with 24 languages, simultaneous translation from Brussels to, you know, a little chapel room in the middle of the Florence Hills with citizens talking directly through different languages and coming up with really innovating proposal. Wow, that was an amazing process and experiment. And yet, very few people around Europe knew about it, or maybe they'd vaguely heard of the term conference, but they didn't know what was going on. So to this day, we need to amplify in many different ways what happened over the last year.
Sorry to interrupt. Yeah, and that's why we called it Amplify. Definitely, the idea is to amplify and basically spread awareness of the work of the conference and the conclusions of the conference. And that actually brings me to my next question, which is you are kind of in a unique position because you are a scholar of democratic politics, transnational democracy. So what did you think about the process of the conference? Now, this is because it was in part deliberative, where citizens get together with one another, representative sample of citizens get together and hash out kind of political issues. But it was also a participatory process in that the citizens also went to the plenary and actually were and the process was designed to bring the European politicians in contact with actual citizens. Do you think that those two aspects, maybe perhaps it was kind of a hybrid, though, as a whole, this kind of conference process, do you think that it worked?
Ian, you're absolutely right that this was the most, in a way, innovative of the whole process. The idea that, first of all, you would have transnational citizens assemblies, because let's remind everyone that we may have had, above 1,000 in the last two decades, very citizens assemblies around the world, but as well documented by OECD and others. But they have been all local or national. So it was, and the EU has organized transnational focus groups. I mean, there's kind of precedence, but in terms of a systematically organized, this was a first. So first of all, and in that sense, a success. And secondly, that interaction with politician was in a way a learning process in public. So we could all observe the progression from the beginnings where the citizens were frustrated because it was a very constrained setting where they had to make speeches, not really have a conversation in these rooms of the parliament, European Parliament. The politicians were kind of in their element, but how do they listen to the citizens and why should they give so much primacy to citizens' recommendation? Why aren't their recommendation equal to the citizens? Clearly, they wanted to get to an end point, which was to take the citizens' recommendation and adapt them to what the parliamentarians and the politicians kind of know is already being done, is in the process of being done, everything that's much more formal in European lawmaking or decision making. And clearly that we had a bit of a clash of culture, of citizens we wanted to voice much more spontaneously, and politicians and even more lawmakers, not all, only politicians, who had their habitual process, their habitus. And so the beauty of what happened was that these we went from clash to cooperation, to kind of a better mutual understanding by the end of it. It wasn't perfect. Clearly, it wasn't perfect, but that's the beauty of this process. It's a learning process. So we could say, we could have commentary on how the citizens were chosen in the first place. Was the selection inclusive enough? Do people self-select? We had a wonderful anecdote at one point where in the plenary, we had this young woman who said, well, I'm here because my father didn't want to come. And he knew I loved Europe, so I came. So she exposed in public that the selection was biased. I'm very happy for her. She was there. But, you know, so there's three moments. There's the selection story. There is the process itself that you're asking about. And I, you know, tried to describe some of the difficulty and how do you include, how do you create a process that's much more citizens friendly? How do you choose so-called experts in a much more fluid and visible way, transparent? So throughout, much more transparency. How are these texts prepared? How are the final recommendations prepared? We need more transparency. And more connection, and we're back to your Amplify, you know, with all the other vivid forces of democracy in Europe, so social movements, trade unions, parties, even in that process. They were kind of there, here and there, but the integration wasn't good enough. So the integration between so-called mini publics, or randomly citizens, and the maxi publics, the publics out there. But Ian, if you allow me to make one more point about all of this process, which is that, you know, some people might know that for the, you know, I came up with a theory during the last constitutional convention in 2001, 2003, which, of course, a convention that ended up with the Treaty of Lisbon, but with a really big problem in the middle, which is the French and Dutch know. And I observed at the time, we're talking 20 years ago, that what really mattered in Europe and we didn't have enough of is when we speak about European democracy is horizontal connection between the peoples of Europe. Not just connection at the top in comitology and in, around the table with ministers and prime ministers prepared by the commission, the whole EU process, very, very much perceived by the citizen at the top. So what we needed was this horizontal connection. And my theory, I labeled demoicracy, this kind of third way that we don't want European democracy to be all at the top in the European Parliament or all at the national level, but connecting these local and national levels in much more entangled way. And we just had the Nobel Prize of Physics yesterday, Ian, which all about entanglement. So we need to create social entanglement as well as reflecting the entanglement of our neurons and our protons and our electrons, where we have to have the body politics have these horizontal entanglements. So this is the bigger picture by which I believe that this process is so important and needs to continue, because for me, it is the incarnation of what I call and call for, which is demoicracy in Europe.
That's and we're, I'm sure many of your listeners will be familiar with your theory of demoicracy. I certainly am. But just to reflect just for a minute longer about this process, because I mean, it's very meta, the fact that if you have this transnational democratic process that is intended to design or influence the design of transnational democracy, to make they're supposed to make recommendations about how to improve transnational democracy, and so you have the process and the substance are entangled, and then you as an expert are also supposed to be there coaching or not coaching or at least advising about how about expertise on transnational democracy, even though being a good Democrat, you don't want to impose your opinion on the process. And so, did it work?
Did
this whole process work, given that, given how much, given how very open it was in this way?
Did it work? I would say it worked. It absolutely worked within the constraint that it had set itself. And these constraints were about, above all, having the three core EU institutions, Commission, Parliament, and Council, work together at every moment to frame the process in the first place, to engineer the type of deliberation that they felt was in their collective, you know, constraint and agreement zone, as it were. And now, to the extent that, you know, we are also constrained in that we are looking to follow up with a constitutional convention, but the council is not quite sure that it wants it, in part because, well, that might be call for referenda, which we've learned is not something that is beloved in the Brussels context. So for all of these reasons, there were constraints, and one understands these constraints because that's what the EU is all about. It is an intergovernmental process supported by supranational capacities. And we know what the EU is, and it's good for it. It couldn't really be otherwise in some ways. But what all of us transnational democracy fans, let's not call us experts, believe is that the EU will not be resilient, democratically resilient and sustained over time by its peoples if it doesn't radically, do a democratic whatever it takes. You know, we've done Euro whatever it takes. Let's do a democratic whatever it takes, so that it is visible, that people feel ownership and that they have ownership. It's not just in terms of perception. There's a lot of scholarly work looking at all these assemblies and these processes of deliberation and what they add to opinions, how they tend to depolarize, how they are able to generate new ideas, how they're able to mobilize, you know, so-called collective intelligence. You know, colleagues like Claudia Schwalitz and Ellen Lendemore have written beautifully about this. And Alberto Almano and I, after the conference in Florence, also commented on what we called Citizens Power Europe, that if you ask me, if Europe was able to do this, it would actually have draw a normative power, and that would also be of great interest to the rest of the world that we need to learn from and interact with on these issues. So I'm trying to paint very quickly a picture where deliberative democracy, you know, becomes front and center and is not something that just happens in parliaments, also happens in parliaments, but that there is much more conversation. And that the rules of the game become clearer to citizens, because, for instance, in the French Citizens Assembly on climate, there was a lot of interesting things that happened, a lot of positives we can talk about, but it wasn't quite clear what would be done with the results. I, for one, wouldn't say that the success would be measured by how binding these recommendations are. Yes, they need to have effect. Citizens need to know they haven't wasted their time. They abandoned their families 3 weekends in a row. It had to be for something, absolutely. And in certain contexts, say in municipal contexts, I think it makes sense to say that their conclusions should be binding, or at least binding to go to a referendum, for instance, mm-hmm. but very well prepared, or binding to go to the parliament that then needs to give reasons for what it does with them. There are different ways of interpreting binding. But what I'm trying to say here, Ian, is that you know better than I do, and then at DCU's Brexit Institute, you know and illustrate all the time, that there is no such thing as one body in the EU making anything binding. Everything is negotiated. And the Commission certainly can't. It can initiate, but then we have the Parliament and the Council negotiating. And then, of course, the Court of Justice intervenes, says, no, you can't do this, or yes, you can do that. And then you have advisory bodies, you know, regional, the Council, regional Council, and all of that. And then you have sub-processes like deciding how the structural fund or the recovery fund will be implemented. And that's elements of that are binding in subgroups, or maybe the Euro group is binding and we have variable geometry with sub-binding groups. So the point is, and again, I'm speaking really fast, sorry, Ian, but the point is, you know, you can't just have, there is no God in the EU, which says thou shalt do. Even the citizens, I mean, if you ask me, the ultimate, you know, constituent power in the EU should be the citizens in various configurations. But there we have it, in which configuration? So the point is, it will always be a conversation between the citizens and the politicians, between the police, the body politics, and the institutions, among the institutions. So we all need to think really hard about how this will work in the future in a way that gives the citizens a sense that their voice really makes a difference, and it's not going to be cherry-picked, and others will decide, you know, what is relevant in what they say. But nor can we just say, well, the assembly will meet and that will be the final word.
Right. So that brings me to, I guess you mentioned follow-up. Even in practical terms, can you say what you think were the most important recommendations that came out of the, that particular citizens panel, and also out of the conference as a whole, when it specifically about the rule of law and democracy, and whether they have any chance of becoming implemented, whether it requires treaty change or not, whether you think that will be the most important legacy of the conference, or maybe the most important legacy will that the conference could serve as a model for future exercises in public consultation in the EU. So what's the upshot?
Ian, I invite our listeners to go and read all of the 149 recommendations that came out in every field, because it's not just a panel that met on democracy and the rule of law. I mean, we have recommendations on climate change and on trade, on budgets, on the economy, on foreign policy, et cetera, et cetera. So lots of fascinating recommendations. Some of them are easily translatable in law. Others are kind of mindsets. And the EU then says, well, a lot of it, our institution will say and have said, you know, we've done some of this. I think it's important not to say that too much, you know, been there, done that, because the citizens express it in a different way. So reflecting back on what they really mean and how we can really be faithful to their conversation will be very important. And in that sense, yes, you know, just to give just a very, very few examples, I think there's a lot of call for more civic education, just knowing about the EU, but not knowing in a passive way. Like the teacher takes a bunch of 10 years old and gives them a PowerPoint of council, commission, parliament. Ooh, boring. No, but how it functions. Have a mock council, like the, you know, mock negotiation, and let them live it, you know, and especially across borders. So everything that has to do with civic education, knowing about the EU, having their say. Now, another bit of that is they're trying to wrap their head around and make advice on how coercive the EU should be, which is a really difficult question, because they understood very well, and I listened to some of these conversations, that they, you know, they have the same ambivalence as, you know, politicians, that we can't tell countries what to do. I mean, the EU is not just as the Brits would say, you know, it's not a super state, but can we really allow a country like Hungary to totally flaunt, you know, free speech, free press, free assembly, freedom of assembly, etc., in their country, and still use EU funds, our taxpayers' money, to enable that? And there were some calls by the citizens, for instance, to be more forceful on, well, mm-hmm. so-called Article 7, but forget Article 7, you know, the conditionality for funds, for instance. So we need to think about this and how to empower, you know, actors in cities and other configurations in countries that are drifting, and everywhere around Europe. So I think that's another route. But you just mentioned it, Ian, too. There was a recommendation, in fact, the very last one, not the least important, in Florence, which was to pursue what we have done, the citizens, for at the 200 in the future in a permanent way in Europe. So this comes under the label, you know, creating a permanent citizens assembly in the EU. And many of us in the social movement world, now I'm putting on another hat, but I think that in, to some extent, you know, academics are often involved as actors and activists in these processes. And definitely I am, because I really believe in it. And so along with many others, including my friends at Citizens Take Over Europe, you know, we've been advocating for a permanent citizens assembly. But in different configurations, we're trying to think through what this would really mean. Because maybe it's not assembly singular, but assembly plural, assemblies plural. Maybe it's networks of assemblies. How do you involve local and national level? The EU is not like the city of Paris, which has just set up one such. It's a whole world of 470 million people. How do you give a sense that it makes any sense to have a citizen assembly of 500, say, sitting in Brussels? No, it shouldn't. Maybe it shouldn't sit in Brussels. Maybe it should rotate around Europe. All of these ideas are going to be played with and played around, you know, I think in the next year or two, as in the meanwhile, the Commission is experimenting with, you know, smaller scale follow up, doing panels for, you know, organized by itself. There will be a feedback on December 2nd to the citizens organized by the Commission. We will see what this yields. But the point is, nobody's forgetting what happened in Conference on the Future of Europe. And certainly, les forces vives de l'Europe are not. And we'll all want to continue and maybe apply it to very specific questions.
Thank you for that. And thank you for that very thoughtful answer. And I guess, I mean, we were going to talk about Next Generation EU, but perhaps it just, if you could just think about Next Generation EU, tie it into this kind of debate about the Conference on the Future of Europe. Now, of course, you the citizens panel you were working on wasn't the one on the economy, but do you think, did you get a sense that the conference was in favor of kind of a Hamiltonian moment at the EU level of that the European Union should become more active as an economic power involved in spending having a transnational budget with real teeth that could actually address the priorities of citizens.
Ian, can I just answer on Next Generation EU? Yes, but. And we had a very interesting conversation with the Brexit Institute a little while back around this theme. But I would add let me just stop here because there's too many buts and stuff. So I'm just going to restart the answer.
Okay, restarting the answer on Next Generation EU.
On Next Generation EU. Okay. So, a little drink. Starting to be out of breath. Right. Yes, Ian, Next Generation EU is probably the biggest topic for thinking about how the EU needs to address the big transitions of our time. Climate change, digital transition, as well as geopolitical transition now these days, even greater with the Ukraine war. And I think there is very little doubt in overall European public opinion. If you look at the polls, that between 70 and 80% of people think the EU should be doing more on these big issues, including because I think the COVID moment was so important that gave rise to Next Generation EU, which after all, in a way, to simplify, multiply the EU budget by two, from 1% to 2%, very big simplification. So there was a sense with COVID that suddenly solidarity is a good thing. Solidarity in the euro crisis was kind of tainted by perceptions and misperceptions that, you know, we shouldn't give money to people who are to blame, like the bad Greeks. or sometimes the Italians. So, I mean, I would contest this because I think the blame was on all sides. But anyway, in terms of public opinion, there was a lot of hesitancy, especially as we know in the north. Whereas with COVID, it's more like a volcano. It's nobody's fault. It fell from the sky or from the air. And so solidarity is much more accepted and internalized socially as a social contract transborder in Europe. And that is the social conditions that made it possible to create and promote an idea like the recovery fund. And I think people understand that it's big when they kind of know about it. And when they hear, you know, 800 billion, whoa, I mean, you and I know that it's not quite 800 billion because whatever is only loans, a lot of countries don't pick it up. But anyway, it's a big sum, especially in Italy, 183 billion. Wow, that's a lot of money and it can do a lot of things. Whether it's a Hamiltonian moment will depend on what it delivers, but also on the process and on the perceived process by which this money is spent. And this brings us back to our deliberative processes. Because when money is spent, this is when people really want to have a say. And I like to say that, and I said it with the conference on the future of Europe to the citizens, the more the EU does things up, the more issues go up, the more decision-making or at least involvement needs to go down. It's one of those things. You have to do a bit of aerobics, Ian. It's very good for us. Up and down. So down means that, okay, we're spending more EU money. EU is gaining more competence. Citizens need to be involved, whether we're talking about regional or structural funds or now the recovery fund. And that's when we need to be very, if not critical, very cognizant to at least les zones d'ombre, the kind of blind spots of the recovery fund. And I'm not, I don't want to speak lightly about this. I did write a piece that was called Once in a Lifetime, an Imminent Critique of the Next Generation Fund, where the sum of this is spelled out. I'm not saying that the designers of the funds are not aware of it, but there are three moments that we need to think really hard about. First of all, that there is no spending without taxation. This is not money from the sky. We hear, well, we'll tax the GAFAs or we'll have an external border adjustment tax on carbon emissions. Yeah, but you know, money is fungible. Even if that money doesn't come directly from the pockets of the EU citizens, it's still money. We won't have something else. So this is taxation. And when you have taxation too, you should have no taxation without representation. So we need to think very hard about representation in the way this money is spent. Now, the answer from Brussels will come and say, well, you know, heads of states looked at it and national parliaments looked at it. But I looked at how national parliaments looked at it and it was very perfunctory. You know, the Italian parliament had one intervention in the whole scheme for Italy, you know, a third of which has already been spent. And this was to spend more money in the south of Italy. Okay, fine, I'm happy with that, but that's not enough. And in fact, it brings us to the third layer, which really matters here, which is, you know, at this stage of the game, no representation without participation. And that's the whole conversation. It's not just representation as parliament. The COFI has taught us, but not just the COFI, the new deliberative wave in general, that representation, classic representation, is not enough. I'm not part of the scholars who say we shouldn't have it at all. You know, we should replace the whole damn lot with randomly selected citizens. That's not my opinion, but I do believe that we need to radically increase the participatory and deliberative part of how we spend money. If solar, you know, the Mezzogiorno is going to be is going to have solar panels everywhere, or the Peloponnese, or you know, these parts of Europe that can really deliver on solar and energy, which is the firm that is getting the contract? How did it spend? Did we get value for money? You know, and because we need to watch on corruption and nepotism through these processes, and who better than the citizens, as well as more on the positive side, how can it be done better? They're locals, they know. And frankly, if you ask me, Ian, but anyone who's listening, please write to me if you know where these processes have been radically democratic and participatory and deliberative. I'm not sure. I know it would be complicated, make it more complicated, but I think it's way time that European citizens own the way in which Brussels is spending their taxpayers' money.
Okay, and that's, you've beautifully brought together the discussion about the conference of the future of Europe, about participation, with the debate about the next generation EU. Mentioned for the listeners' sake that the event where Calypso was a speaker is also available on our podcast feed on the Amplify as part of the Amplify series. Now, begging Calypso's indulgence, I'd like to broaden out the conversation even a bit more, just to talk about the future of Europe. Calypso has such diverse interests and has published so widely that she can talk about practically anything. But today, I mentioned this today, we're talking on October 6th, which is the day of the inaugural meeting of the European Political Community, where I think representatives of 44 member state European countries, that includes EU and non-EU countries, are meeting in Prague. Now, do you think this is possibly a promising format for a constructive relationship between the EU and its neighbors?
Yeah, and thanks for your kind words. And while I am interested in too many things, I won't pretend that while I'm here with you, there is my clone in that secret meeting in Prague. So you and I and all the listeners, well, by the time we are online, of course, we will know what has happened at this meeting. But part of the problem is to me that these are not involving enough citizens, etc. But let's hope that in the future, yes, this process becomes itself a deliberative political process in the sense of body politics, because actually on this moment, on this European political community idea, I am also very hopeful. So you see, everything I said today is kind of in some ways critical but hopeful, which is, you know, how I like to look at the world. And because I think that being a critical friend is perhaps the best service you can do to all of this. And, you know, we can have a cynical side to our commentary on what is going on. After all, Mitterrand, after the end of the Cold War, proposed the same thing, European House. But remember that at the time, he proposed it to really, above all, include Russia in a European security architecture. It was an inclusive proposal. In this case, and now, of course, circumstances have radically changed. And one bit of this whole story is exclusive. It's not Russia. In fact, it's a response to Russia's 19th century geopolitics of spheres of influence and trying to be inclusive in response. But for the moment, you know, in some ways as a response, let's not even say against Russia, because I like to think that, you know, we're responding to Putin, but that the Russian people is somewhere else, not at least a good proportion of them, or will be in the near future, and that all of this needs to continue to be done in such a way that Russia will come in the European House at some point. But for the moment, we are looking at a forum which does include today, as we speak, the Balkan countries, Southeast Europe, as well as Britain. So Liz Truss said, yes, je suis présente, and is come, and you and I will rejoice in that. Because of course, all of the other EFTA countries and Switzerland and Norway, but they're already talking a lot with the EU. So, I mean, these two ends are very important, Britain and Southeast Europe. And there hasn't been a forum where there could be a free discussion about the big strategic issues of our times that we're confronting, which I like to summarize, Ian, as in my mind, as 20 seconds. 20 seconds is the difference between how long it would take a Russian nuclear missile to reach Paris and London. And my question is, given 20 seconds, why do we worry about, you know, sausages and whether they're frozen or not? I mean, there is a kind of disconnect here, you know, cognitive dissonance. And so, you know, leaving aside all the Brexit negotiation, another passion of mine, I would say, and of course, in the context of the Brexit Institute, we've had a lot of fascinating discussions about this crazy moment of ours in trans-channel politics. But we need a forum in Europe where we think strategically together, where the EU, of course, is super important, is at the center. But no, maybe shouldn't be at the center. One participant, but where the others are part. And here, yes, Britain, the 22nd, Britain as a strategic, you know, NATO partner. I'm crazy that it wouldn't be part of a security discussion in Europe. But also for talking politics, let's not forget the importance of the Southern Europe, the Western Balkans that have been candidates for 20 years are waiting, knocking at the door. The instability in these countries, the disillusionment about EU, the inroads that China and Russia are making where when the EU leaves a vacuum, the EU is present. But the EU needs to give the region more of a sense that their future is together. And I know I'm not the only one to say this, and it's not very original, but it's very concrete. And we need to mobilize around this new prospects of enlargement. I think the promise to Ukraine is going to create a new setting where we can do that better. We can't think Ukraine without thinking Southeast Europe. And we can't do Ukraine enlargement without doing Southeast Europe enlargement. So this is a very, very big chantier where the rule of law questions are so important, where we need to see a Southeast Europe where its citizens know that the rule of law is like oxygen. You notice it when you don't have it anymore. And therefore, they need to own that. It shouldn't just be a diktat from the EU, that their economies need to be underpinned by an infrastructure of rule of law, culture of rule of law, that all of us in Europe need to improve. So let's hope that this process will also, the process starting today on the political community, will create a new dynamics on enlargement.
That's a really interesting answer to that question. I guess in thinking about the European political community, a complaint about the European Union is that it has kind of a quasi-imperial relationship with its neighbors in the sense that it's not multilateral. The EU relates to individual countries on a bilateral basis, but there's no multilateral forum for them to all take part in a conversation on a more equal basis.
Exactly. I mean, absolutely, Ian. I think, sorry, I
interrupted. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I mean, and it's partly while I would insist that this process also be linked to enlargement, because there's been this fear that it's just another waiting room to just slow down enlargement, a kind of box checking and all the rest of it, which often these kinds of things can be, and especially the one for the moment, there's no secretariat or anything. So what is it about? And we can be a bit skeptical along these lines and hold this process to account. But I agree that all the countries that are OSCE and should not, the EU has to be careful not to itself look and feel like a sphere of influence process, as you say, as like a kind of neo-imperial standards of civilization will tell you what the right thing is to do, which is very counterproductive, because you can't hope that countries in the neighborhood, so-called neighborhood, I don't like so much this word because it means there are neighbors, but where are their neighbors? So anyway, that countries in the neighborhood apply a set of governance standards, set of so-called democracy standards. But what is democracy if it's not a set of practices that people invent and reinvent all the time and imagine themselves inventing as the authors of their polity? I mean, that's what democracy is. So there is a bit of a contradiction of the EU just going there top down and saying, these are our standards. This is your country blueprint and action plan and all the rest of it. And then, oh, also, you need to be democratic. Well, democratic is you've got to do it yourself. You've got to own it yourself. And this whole question of ownership is an old one in scholarship, etc. But it's really time that the EU, you know, internalizes it better. And if a multilateral forum like this one, I mean, hopefully, I agree with you, Ian, could potentially, I don't think today, I mean, today they're having little discussions around roundtable, they're just starting, but it could be the trigger for something bigger, a rethinking, a multilateralization and a mutualization and of these process of relationship between the EU and other countries, and making, and at the end of the day, turning them into, you know, conversations that are truly, truly symmetric. And that's very hard because in this kind of imperial, you know, reflex is a bit in the EU's DNA, not just because some of its member states were colonial states, but because the EU thinks of itself as a laboratory, you know, a model for transnational governance. I think it shouldn't be a model or tell the world that it's a model or in whatever setting, but maybe a laboratory is okay because a laboratory means we make mistakes as many as we make, as we have successful, you know, process, so we might as well, you know, share them with the rest of the world. But if we do that, we need to listen to others and their experience and be humble about the value of all of these other experiences. And of course, I say humble, then we need to be super humble when we see what is happening in Ukraine and how all of them, you know, exhibit courage and belief in the future.
Yeah. That leads me to, I guess, one final question, if I can beg your indulgence, and you've been very, very generous with your time. At our meeting in June, we spoke with Neil Richmond, who was a member of the Irish Parliament, and he was there at the Citizens Panel that took place in Dublin, happened literally the day after the invasion of Ukraine. And he said that you could feel it in the atmosphere of the place, that suddenly everything got much more serious and people felt like the stakes had been raised. It didn't make them think that the conference was a waste of time, not at all. I mean, but it made them feel that in fact the work of the conference was that much more important in this kind of changed context. Do you feel the same way?
Absolutely. And I want to say that the panel that was organized in the Dublin Castle, we followed very closely. I mean, we worked with our friends and colleagues on the facilitator side and on the expert side and academic side. So all of our different experiences in these four places were connected, and we really thought to work together. And of course, the panel in Dublin, it was, you know, one of these clash of moments, as you just described it, Ian, because they were supposed to talk about the economy and social justice, you know, youth, all of these, and digital issues. So all of these issues that were that really underpin the solidity, the resilience of the EU in today's world, and then suddenly we have war at our door, and the question is, you know, does this make, I remember listening in and the citizens, you know, expressed their solidarity. But I believe and hope that they understood that their process was a way of contributing to Europe's response. I mean, there are many different ways in which we have contributed, we should contribute more, starting with, you know, arms delivery. And in the future, it will be all, but in the future, it will all be about reconstruction, about stronger economies, more inclusive economies, that dealing with precarity of people. And that has both to do with, you know, Europe's resilience, indeed, and strategic autonomy, but also, you know, Ukraine's resilience in the future. So to some extent, that conversation in Dublin was made all the more necessary in the longer term by the Ukraine war. Because at the end of the day, I think what we are learning in the EU is that we respond to crisis. We're getting better at this. Faster and faster, yes, more effectively, yes. But what we still need to learn is to respond to crisis with a view to the long term. Because if we responded to the euro crisis 10 years ago with a view to the long term, probably there would be better outcomes today. So this long term, this EU being the guardian of the long term, economically, militarily, strategically, politically, needs to become part, again, of our DNA. To me, that's what I call sustainable integration. And I think that's what this Dublin panel, which brings us all the way back to the Brexit Institute, was about in this amazingly challenging moment that all Europeans were living alongside the citizens that were meeting there.
Well, Calypso Nikolaidis, thank you so much for your time. That's a wonderful place to draw this discussion to a close.
Thank you, Ian, and thanks to the Institute and everyone listening. Conversation will continue.
It will indeed. Thank you.
You've been listening to Amplify, which is made with the support of the European Union's Erasmus Plus program and the Irish Department of Foreign Affairs Communicating Europe initiative, although these institutions do not necessarily endorse its contents. It is produced by the DCU Brexit Institute in association with the Jean Monnet Centre of Excellence Rebuild. The host is Ian Cooper. The producer is Lucrezia Rossi. Music by Doug Romanoff.